Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Oncology Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Quill. Today's episode is based on a live Cancer Conversations presentation featuring breast cancer experts Dr. Mark Pegram from Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, and Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. Together, they will provide expert perspectives on newer developments in the management of patients with early stage or advanced triple negative breast cancer, including points of consensus and key remaining clinical questions. This episode is part of a larger educational program titled Smarter, Stronger Together, Optimizing Personalized Triple Negative Breast Cancer Care for Providers and Patients. For more information on Dr. Pegram and Dr. Tulaney, along with a link to the complete program, including downloadable slides, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what the experts have to say.
This is going to be a case-based discussion, and so we're going to launch right into the first case with a focus on triple-negative breast cancer. The first case is a 43-year-old woman who presented with a 46-millimeter left upper outer corner breast mass and a 38-millimeter lymph node. She was diagnosed with clinical T2N2 breast cancer, triple-negative phenotype. There was some TIL infiltration. The PD-L1 was negative by the 22C3 immunohistochemical assay for a combined positive score of less than one. More on that issue later. A genomic panel testing revealed a pathogenic STK11 Peutz-Jeghers syndrome germline mutation, and that's what makes this case a little bit more challenging. As you'll recall, the Peutz-Jeghers syndrome is a high penetrance autosomal dominant syndrome occurring with an incidence of about 1 in 100,000. Patients present with hamartomatous polyposis syndromes. It involves multiple polyps in the gastrointestinal tract, often jejunal, and a dark pigment melanocytic spots on the lips and oral mucosa. The gene encodes a member of a serine threonine kinase family that regulates cell polarity and functions as a tumor suppressor by phosphorylating AMP kinase and about a dozen other AMPK-related family kinase substrates. This patient's imaging, the mammogram, which is a large mass there, MRI images showing this mass, and the colorized MRI scans showing that this is a highly vascularized structure indeed, and of course was highly suspicious for a malignancy. This patient had the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. She had a clinical complete response as well as a pathologic complete response to pembrolizumab chemotherapy, neoadjuvant therapy. The rationale for this treatment option stems from the KEYNOTE-522 trial, in which patients with newly diagnosed disease that was at least T1C, N1 or N2, or T2 to 4, N0 to 2 triple negative breast cancer. T2 N0s actually didn't qualify for that trial. More about that later. Good to excellent performance status, and a tissue sample had to be available for PD-L1 testing, but that was done post hoc. That was not a requirement for eligibility because both PD-L1 positive and negative patients were enrolled in this study by design. Over 1,000 patients enrolled in this trial. It's placebo-controlled in the neoadjuvant phase as well as in the adjuvant phase. 2-to-1 randomization also was an interesting feature of this trial, so patients were more likely to be randomized to the pembrolizumab experimental arm. The primary endpoints included pathologic complete response by local review as well as event-free survival by local review. Key secondary endpoints included different definitions of the PCR, OS, event-free survival in the PD-L1 positive subgroup, safety, and quality of life. In terms of the results in the intent to treat population, the PCR rates favored the subjects randomized to the pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy experimental arm. And this difference was highly statistically significant with an absolute difference of about 13.5%. The PCR by PD-L1 status, both for the PD-L1 positive as well as the PD-L1 negative subsets, there was still superiority in the pembrolizumab randomized subjects compared to a chemotherapy placebo control. And so that's why PD-L1 is not used in the neoadjuvant setting as the basis for selection of immune checkpoint inhibition with pembrolizumab, because both subgroups benefit. There's a higher PCR rate, to be sure, on the PD-L1 positive patients compared to PD-L1 negative, but being PD-L1 negative and being randomized to pembrolizumab is still a better outcome. And the absolute differences are in the 14 to 18% range for positive and negative range patients, respectively. There have been a number of immune checkpoint inhibitor breast cancer trials in the early stage setting, pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, and durvalumab. Some of these antibodies target PD-L1, while others target PD-1. Most of these trials included rather high-stage patients, usually stage 2 or 3, except for the Gepa-Nuevo trial that included about a third of patients that were stage 1. Most of the chemo backbones were anthracycline-based, and some of them also included carboplatin in all of these trials and composite. The PCR rates, they're quite respectable for triple negative early breast cancer, especially considering the high stage in most of these trials. To have PCR rates north of 50% for most of the studies is impressive. Most of these trials were anthracycline-based, but that's still an open question. There has been a pick-a-winner trial called TONIC in combination with immune checkpoint inhibition in triple negative metastatic disease, where anthracycline is compared favorably to other chemo backbones or to radiation therapy indeed. PD-L1 status does not matter across these trials, as I showed you in the case of KEYNOTE-522. And other variables may play an important role. I believe that it may not be so much as enumeration of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, but rather enumeration of particular subsets of particular white blood cell populations in the tumor itself or in the tumor microenvironment. And that's been measured in a trial called NeoTRIP using a technology that was invented here at Stanford, using metal ions as the basis for conjugation to IHC detection antibodies. And in that fashion, you can do multiple plex immune infiltrating immunophenotypes in the same experiment with one thin section of a paraffin embedded tumor. And that study showed that it was not just simple enumeration of TILs or PD-L1 that mattered the most in predicting PCR. It was actually tumor and immune effector cell interactions, cell contacts, and particular immunophenotypes of those cells were superior in predicting PCR. So I think the wave of the future for that line of investigation is to look at these multiplex platforms to really characterize the infiltrating tumor immune repertoire as the best predictor for response to immune checkpoint inhibition in early breast cancer. Next, we're going to have some discussion points, and I'll invite my colleague, Dr. Tulaney, to chime in here. The first point I want to raise is this issue of the definition of triple-negative breast cancer. Do you treat all these patients based on the ASCO-CAP guidelines for steroid receptor detection? Do you cut off a VR of 1%, or are you more liberal and do you acknowledge that there may be some patients with lower levels of ER that may still have a TNBC clinical behavior and clinical phenotype?
Yeah, it's an excellent question and actually a very practical question, because we do see these path reports sometimes with 2% ER or 3% ER, and you're really faced with the challenge about how to approach that patient, where the approach is actually dramatically different if you think of them as a hormone receptor positive cancer compared to triple negative cancer. And we do have some data to suggest that these really low ER patients, and when you look at intrinsic subtype, actually predominantly look like a basal-like cancer. And so very much do look like the more typical triple negative cancer. And so because of that, I usually do think about these very low ER patients more as triple negative and approach them as such. So for example, if someone has ER pair under 5%, then I am thinking about them again more like a triple negative. Again, if they have the other sort of high grade, low ER, then I would think about this. Certainly they weren't eligible for KEYNOTE-522. They did use the standard ASCO CAP guideline definition, but I think in clinical practice, I do think about particularly under 5%. There are some who argue under 10%, but I think under 5 is a safe way to think about it.
Completely agree with you, particularly about the basal intrinsic phenotype of breast cancer. It's been shown, for example, that in steroid receptor positive patients who have a basal-like phenotype, they do not respond well to CDK4/6 inhibition combined with endocrine therapy, for example. So I wonder if this is a path forward or assays like PAM50 in the future, should we be using those types of approaches to define these phenotypes in these gray areas of low ER? That's a question for future research. Who shouldn't receive neoadjuvant pembrolizumab, if anyone?
Pembrolizumab does seem to be infiltrating cancers. But I will say that right now for neoadjuvant pembrolizumab, at this point in time in breast cancer, we really only have data for using it in triple negative disease, certainly not yet in ER positive or HER2 positive disease. And amongst the triple negative patients, it was restricted to stage 2 and 3 patients at KEYNOTE-522. And so that's typically who I am using the 522 regimen in. I am not utilizing that regimen with pembrolizumab in patients with stage one disease. I think this becomes a risk-benefit decision because we do know that if you look at the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, one, it's a lot of chemotherapy, anthracycline, cyclophosphamide, taxane, platinum, and we've added a checkpoint inhibitor to that backbone. So it's a lot of treatment. And I think you do have to pick and choose appropriate patients. So certainly one group of patients that is excluded in my mind from use of pembrolizumab right now is stage one disease. I think obviously we have to look at patients who may have contraindications to checkpoint inhibition. So someone who has severe autoimmune diseases requiring immunosuppressive therapy would not be an ideal candidate for checkpoint inhibition. So someone with autoimmune colitis that requires steroid therapy, for example, is not someone that I'm excited about thinking about checkpoint inhibition for. So usually those are the two things in my head is stage and then contraindications to checkpoint.
I agree. The one thing to remember perhaps for tumor boards, et cetera, is that the T2N0s were allowed in KEYNOTE-522 per protocol. The FDA label language for this indication says, quote, for the treatment of patients with high risk early stage triple negative breast cancer in combination with chemotherapy as neoadjuvant treatment. So it's not otherwise specified by the label language, but if you are a purist and follow the protocol, T2N0 was the lowest stage that was allowed in the protocol. Now, what if the converse happens? What if you have a patient with residual disease following the neoadjuvant component of KEYNOTE-522? What do you do then? Do you just give them the 9 cycles of pembrolizumab because that's in the label and that was the study design in KEYNOTE-522? Or should we switch them to capecitabine or add capecitabine to immune checkpoint inhibition? Any thoughts about that?
Again, very good question. No, the challenge was when KEYNOTE-522 was first designed, it was prior to having data from CREATEX showing that we could adapt our treatment decisions based on response to preoperative therapy. So we certainly have data in a setting where patients had not received preoperative checkpoint that if they got, you know, anthracycline taxane-based pre-op chemotherapy and had residual disease using 8 cycles of adjuvant capecitabine did improve both disease-free and overall survival for patients with triple-negative breast cancer in that subset of CREATEX. So that has been our standard, but in 522, again, everyone, as you said, just got 9 cycles of pembro in the adjuvant setting, irrespective of response, whether you had a PCR or you had residual disease, you weren't allowed to add on additional therapies. But my worry is that if we look at those patients who had residual disease in 522, they still do have significant risk of a recurrence. And certainly it was better with pembro, but still, again, there is substantial risk. And so I think we all are a bit anxious about that particular patient population and want to do what we can to help prevent recurrence. And so I typically do utilize capecitabine in combination with pembrolizumab in a patient who has residual disease to pre-op chemo checkpoint. I realize there's absolutely no data to back me up on what the benefit of adding capecitabine is to the pembrolizumab in this setting. We do not have any data yet, but again, knowing their risk, I have thought about doing this. And we do have safety data, at least for the combination, where we do have data for CAPE pembro, both in the metastatic setting and some small series of CAPE checkpoint in the residual disease setting. So that has made me comfortable. I do make sure I've checked for germline BRCA status, because if they were germline BRCA mutant and had residual disease, then I would think about using olaparib for that particular patient instead of capecitabine. Then the question again is, do you give it with the pembro? Do you give it by itself? And again, I have no data to back me up here. In Olympia, these were patients who weren't getting checkpoint inhibition. They just got olaparib as monotherapy if they had residual disease with triple negative breast cancer. So we don't have this data, but personally, I've just been giving both together. We do have safety data for combination PARP checkpoint. We don't know if adding checkpoint to PARP enhances outcome. There's a lot of preclinical data to suggest that may be the case, but we don't yet have randomized data and we're waiting for that data at this time. But again, given the safety data, that's how I have generally approached it.
At least there's a scientific rationale for PARP inhibition combined with immune checkpoint inhibition, in as much as PARP inhibitors have been shown, at least in laboratory experimental models, to hit the CGAS sting pathway. And there is strong rationale for combining sting agonist approaches along with immune checkpoint inhibition that are published. But you're right, it's a data-free zone in terms of clinical medicine yet, whether that's going to be a path forward. Next, let's move on to clinical implications of PD-L1 status on therapeutic planning for metastatic disease. Again, a patient case, a 62-year-old with a 16-millimeter grade 3 infiltrating ductal carcinoma who underwent lobectomy and received TC times 4 followed by radiation, no germline mutations upon genetic testing, high Ki-67, some TIL infiltration for what it's worth. After 16 months, this patient developed a cutaneous chest wall recurrence on follow-up physical examination. The biopsy showed triple-negative breast cancer. Again, a high Ki-67 of 70%. HER2 IHC is 0 in this case. The combined positive score was greater than 10, indicating a PD-L1 positive phenotype. And her staging for distant metastasis was negative. She received pembrolizumab, gemcitabine, and carboplatin based on the KEYNOTE-355 study. And in this case, she developed one of the complications that's known for immune checkpoint inhibitors, and that is she developed a grade 4 pneumonitis on treatment after 2 cycles. For this patient, permanently discontinued pembrolizumab as per the prescribing information from the FDA, and indeed prescribed steroids for grade 4 pneumonitis. This patient had the prednisone equivalent of about 80 milligrams a day for more than a month and a total steroid exposure for about 3 to 4 months, but after a gradual taper was finally able to get off more recently. Following on in this case, she discontinued pembrolizumab and completed 6 cycles of carbo-gem. She underwent mastectomy with residual 1.5 millimeters of infiltrating cancer along with a 0.8 millimeter node. She had radiation to the axilla and left supraclavicular fields and was started on adjuvant capecitabine. She developed rapidly spreading thickened erythematous rash outside her previous radiation field, extending on her back and the costal margin. And a biopsy of the skin overlying one of the left ribs showed metastatic disease. The HER2 IHC 0 on this particular surgical specimen was 0. And the CPS score was net less than 1 on this case in the next specimen after exposure to the immune checkpoint inhibitor. Next generation sequencing showed a P53 mutation and a tumor mutational burden was low at 2, with diffuse involvement of the skin and left chest wall, as well as some contralateral axillary lymphadenopathy. The patient was next treated with a sacituzumab govitecan in this case. And moving on, the rationale for the KEYNOTE-355 regimen in this case was based upon published data showing the results of the overall survival data in the subgroup of patients that were PD-L1 positive based on the 22C3 companion diagnostic and a combined positive score of greater than or equal to 10. The pembro plus chemo group median overall survival was 23 months compared to 16.1 months in the placebo arm, hazard ratio 0.73 and a significant p-value. The median PFS favored the pembro chemo arm compared to placebo chemo control. IMPASSION 130 study for patients with metastatic or inoperable locally advanced triple negative breast cancer and no prior therapy for the advanced setting, RECIST measurable disease, excellent performance status, and tumor evaluable for PD-L1 analysis. Over 900 patients in this trial. This is an atezolizumab trial that's very similar to KEYNOTE-355, except for the use of atezolizumab instead of pembrolizumab. Again, placebo controlled. Primary endpoints of PFS and OSS in the intent-to-treat population and the PD-L1 positive subgroup. IMPASSION 130 study shows the difference in outcome based on PD-L1 expression using the SP142 antibody. There's some discordance between the 22C3 antibody staining results and the SP142 result. They have different cutoff levels. They actually measure different cell populations as well. And there are other PD-L1 assays that are out there. So basically, the data available now say that these assays can't really be harmonized. And consequently, for different antibody therapeutics, initially there were FDA approvals using different primary detection antibodies for PD-L1 based on which study was being considered. However, that's changed more recently because based on a confirmatory trial of atezolizumab in first-line metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, the confirmatory trial failed to confirm the original IMPASSION 130 study, and consequently, that drug is no longer available for patients. And so we typically use 22C3 alone for selection of pembrolizumab since it's the only immune checkpoint inhibitor standing after all the dust has settled with the various trials and 2 different antibodies that have been tested. Next, let's move on to some more discussion about this case and about implications for all patients with metastatic disease. What is your take, Dr. Solani, on the available companion diagnostics in your lab at Dana-Farber, are they still running SP142 at all? Or are they like our facility where the pathologists are no longer interested in SP142 for breast cancer?
Yeah, this has been quite an evolving challenge over the last couple of years, because in truth, we didn't even have SP142 validated in-house at the time we got the initial atezolizumab approval. So we had to validate the antibody, get it running. And finally, just when we have everything smooth sailing so we can do SP142 in-house, we saw the withdrawal of atezolizumab approval and saw pembrolizumab's approval come out. And then we had to shift gears. And in truth, we have to send out 22C3 now to a central lab. We didn't end up taking on doing that in-house. So we do routinely only test our triple negative patients with 22C3 and no longer do SP142. But it goes to show how complicated it is from a pathology standpoint when you get all these companion diagnostics to get things up and running at individual laboratories is challenging.
It used to be that the next generation sequence genomic vendors, some of them used to run both of these assays, reflexly on triple negative breast cancer samples that were metastatic patients as well. But I'm not sure if they've changed their practice as our pathologists have at Stanford. I suspect they probably have dropped SP142, at least for triple negative breast cancer in the first line. The other question that has come up is kind of a trick question. What would you do if somebody had neoadjuvant and adjuvant pembrolizumab for early stage triple negative breast cancer, and then have a metastatic relapse of triple negative breast cancer that's PD-L1 positive? Would you retreat with an immune checkpoint antibody at that
point? Yeah, no, I haven't actually had that come up yet, and given that we haven't been using checkpoint that long in triple negative disease, but I suspect it will be coming, unfortunately, in the not too distant future. And again, here we don't have data to really back up what the right approach is. So I think we always make up these rules. We look at disease-free interval from last dose and we make up some cutoff and say, okay, we shouldn't do that drug again. Like with taxane, we usually say, hey, if it's been at least 12 months from prior taxane, then you can think about reusing it. But if it's shorter, we don't. With checkpoint inhibition, it's going to be a little bit different, because we don't really understand, one, if you can, even if someone progresses on checkpoint, if there could be benefit from even changing the chemo backbone and using checkpoint again. And so it's a little bit of a different phenomenon than, for example, just a chemo resistance issue. And so all bets are off on what the right answer is. But I think personally, my rule of thumb that I'll make up is if it's been 6 months since last dose of checkpoint and they've relapsed and are PD-L1 positive, I probably would re-expose them to checkpoint inhibition, assuming they didn't have any severe IO tox in their previous exposure and were a candidate for further checkpoint. But Mark, what would you do? What rule would you make up in your head?
Yeah, somewhere between 6 months or a year. After a year, I'd probably do it with enthusiasm. Less than a year, I would probably still consider it. Like you said, maybe changing the chemo backbone would have some impact on the generation of new released neoantigens into the tumor microenvironment and associated immune response following immune checkpoint inhibition. So we don't know if that's right. One thing's for certain, the effects of immune checkpoint inhibition can be long-lasting. We sometimes see late immune adverse events after discontinuation of immune checkpoint antibodies, for example. But that gives one pause and makes me wonder if we're adding a whole lot more if we reintroduce the same treatment early on. Certainly under 6 months, I would do it with no enthusiasm. Next, I'll turn the podium over to Dr. Tulaney to continue our discussion on drug conjugates in triple-negative breast cancer.
Sure. Thanks so much, Mark. So we'll start off with the case in this setting. So this is a 56-year-old who had presented with de novo metastatic triple-negative disease. So had found a left-sided breast mass with an ipsilateral enlarged axillary node, and that was biopsied and came back as ER-negative, PR-negative in HER2-1+, and had staging scans done that did show evidence of liver and lung metastases. And so the liver was biopsied and consistent with the original receptors. So again, ER negative, PR negative, HER2-1+. PD-L1 testing was sent using 22C3, and the CPS score was found to be greater than 10. And so she was felt to be PD-L1 positive. She also had germline genetic testing and did not have a germline BRCA mutation. So given that she had metastatic triple negative disease that was PD-L1 positive, she was started off on paclitaxel and pembrolizumab, given the data, as Mark showed us, from KEYNOTE-355, really supporting that you can use chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibition in this upfront setting. However, after about 8 months of being on this regimen, she unfortunately did develop disease progression with growth in the liver metastases. And so now you have someone who you're thinking about a second line treatment approach. And remember, in this case, the patient was HER2 low and was someone who's PD-L1 positive and does not have a germline BRCA mutation. So I think sacituzumab here is a very reasonable choice, as we'll get into based on ASCENT. But now we do have data for use of T-DXd in HER2 low breast cancer, which this patient was, as she had a HER2 1 plus tumor. So you now have these two choices, and we'll go over the data and why it's not so clear what the optimal choice is. So the data for sacituzumab in this setting is very robust because it does come from the ASCENT trial, which was a large randomized phase 3 study where patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer were randomized to get sacituzumab or treatment of physician's choice chemotherapy. In this trial, patients had to have received 2 lines of chemotherapy for metastatic disease, or they could have had 1 line in the metastatic setting, but have recurred very soon after their adjuvant therapy. So if you had early relapse and 1 line, you could have gone on to the study. So you technically could have been a second line metastatic patient, or you could have been 3rd line and beyond. And what they found was that the sacituzumab was associated with a improved progression-free survival and overall survival compared to standard chemotherapy. And I think the results were quite striking because you look at the PFS and the control arm, and it's under 2 months. And I think that really does go to show that, unfortunately, our standard chemotherapies don't work so well in patients who have pretreated triple negative disease. And this is why this has been such an area of unmet need, is trying to get better therapies for this patient population. But you see the sacituzumab here, the PFS was over 5 months. So really a very dramatic difference in PFS and almost a doubling of overall survival. So over 6 months in the control arm to 12 months with sacituzumab. So clearly a significant improvement, making this really a standard choice in the second line and beyond setting. But we also said the patient was HER2 low. So what does HER2 low mean? This wasn't our usual lingo of the way we would describe breast cancer. We used to think of them as ER positive, triple negative, or HER2 positive. But now we have to think, do they have HER2 low positive disease? Meaning, do they have a tumor that has an IHC score of 1 plus or 2 plus and is not amplified by FISH? So it's not a truly HER2 positive tumor, but also not HER2 zero. So a little bit of HER2 staining, so in between the positive and the zero. And there was a study that I think everyone now is very familiar with, which is DESTINY-Breast04, which took patients with metastatic breast cancer that was HER2 low. And it was for patients who had 1 or 2 lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. And then they got randomized to get trastuzumab deruxtecan, also called T-DXd. So that's in essence an antibody drug conjugate that's targeting HER2, but delivering a topoisomerase 1 payload. And it was compared to standard chemotherapy. In this particular trial, the majority of patients were hormone receptor positive. And there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. But there were 58 patients who had triple negative breast cancer that was also HER2 low in this trial. And when you look at the triple negative subset, again, a small number of patients here, you do see a very dramatic improvement in PFS and OS. So you see the chemotherapy alone had a PFS of 2.9 months compared to 8.5 months with T-DXd. And OS went from 8.3 months to 18.2 months. Really, again, very dramatic improvements. I think the caution here was that the numbers here for the triple negative subset are small. That being said, the findings that we saw both in the hormone receptor positive HER2 low and triple negative HER2 low, I think were pretty consistent in findings, where response rates in both of these groups were about 50%. And in essence, you're seeing more than a doubling here in PFS. So, you know, I think clearly this agent works very well, but when you're weighing which drug to give, T-DXd or DESTINY-Breast04, the truth is we do have a large phase 3 study with sacituzumab that was well powered for its endpoint with triple negative disease. And personally, I think if we're trying to be very data-driven, probably the edge goes right now to using sacituzumab first, and then potentially thinking about TDXD next. The challenge, though, that we have is we don't really know how these ADCs perform one after the other. Obviously, there was no one in DESTINY-Breast04 who had seen prior sacituzumab and no one in ASCENT that had seen prior TDXD because these were not standard agents at the time these trials were being designed. And they both have topoisomerase 1 payload. So even though they have different targets, with sacituzumab targeting TROP2 and TDXD targeting HER2, their payloads are cousins of one another, if you will. And it does beg the question, will the activity be as good as it was in DESTINY-Breast04 if you use TDXD after sacituzumab? The truth is we don't really know the answer to that, but there are trials that are planned that are going to be looking at sequential ADC use that I think will be really critical for us to understand resistance mechanisms and understand efficacy in this setting. So I think another factor that comes up when making a treatment decision is certainly to also think about what potential toxicities you might see with that agent and if the patient is a good candidate for the drug, also given their underlying comorbidities. And with sacituzumab, the common things that we see are neutropenia, very common, to the point where about half of patients getting sacituzumab actually need growth factor support in order to be able to stay on schedule. And there is usually low-grade intermittent diarrhea with sacituzumab. So a lot of my patients will use pyrimide as needed, and that seems to do the trick for them. With DESTINY-Breast04 with TDXD, you can see some neutropenia, not as much as you see with sacituzumab, but you can see some. The things that I notice most are nausea. And so with TDXD, I do give prophylactic antiemetics. Usually right now I'm using a 3-drug regimen, treating it like a highly emetogenic agent, which works beautifully for this drug. And the one concern that we do keep top of mind with TDXD is a risk of ILD, where about 10% of patients do end up with interstitial lung disease. And in fact, in DESTINY-Breast04, there were 3 deaths due to ILD. And so we do have to be aware of that. And I do counsel patients about that risk so that they do let me know if they have any symptoms at all of respiratory symptoms. And it is contraindicated if someone's had a prior drug-induced pneumonitis to use TDXD. And if that has been the case, it is important not to use TDXD in that particular setting. For sacituzumab, it is important to let patients know if they have hair, they will lose their hair with it. It is pretty much a guarantee. With TDXD, the rate of alopecia was about 30%, but the rate of grade 2 alopecia was about 10%. So really going bald from TDXD is certainly much lower likelihood than with sacituzumab. I think there are lots of questions that certainly come up now. And Mark, if you're seeing a patient, how do you make this decision between TDXD and sacituzumab?
There's no substitute for level 1 evidence of an overall survival benefit that's statistically significant. So I completely agree with you that there's so much robust data in the case of sacituzumab govitecan. Right now, as we speak in November of 2022, that is the go-to treatment, in my opinion, for those patients, even if they're HER2 low. The other advantage of trastuzumab deruxtecan in theory is its payload is about tenfold more potent than SN38, which is the cytotoxic payload for sacituzumab govitecan. So maybe you could use them in sequence in theory and still maybe expect to capture some responses with TDXD after sacituzumab govitecan, if that's any consolation. In the interest of time, I want to move on to our last case.
Yeah, so this is a 36-year-old woman with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. She had presented with a left-sided breast mass with an enlarged node confirmed by biopsy to be triple-negative, got pre-op dose-dense AC Taxol, had a PCR to therapy, did have germline genetic testing done, did have a BRCA mutation. And 2 years after her original presentation, she was found to have elevated transaminases, got imaging, was found to have liver metastases, was biopsied. That biopsy was consistent with triple negative disease that was HER2 IHC 0. She also had PD-L1 testing done that was negative, so CPS of 2. So I think my personal preference in a PD-L1 negative germline BRCA patient upfront would be a PARP inhibitor. And the reason for that is that we have data for both olaparib or talazoparib in this setting. So you could choose either. The data for olaparib comes from the Olympiad trial. We had olaparib compared to chemo, suggesting a 3-month improvement in progression-free survival. There was no overall survival benefit that was seen. And this was true also for the IMbraca trial with very similar data. We also have data now for Olympia looking at PARP in the adjuvant setting. This particular patient had a PCR and it was a couple of years ago, so it was before this data was available. But if someone had a residual disease, as we alluded to earlier, then we do know that use of olaparib in the adjuvant setting also has benefit in terms of both disease-free and overall survival. These are just the data in the metastatic setting that we reviewed showing that 3-month PFS benefit. And so, Mark, if you saw a first-line triple-negative patient, if we twist it a little bit and say they had a germline BRCA mutation and were PD-L1 positive, what would you then think of doing in terms of ordering your therapy? Because now you have PARP or you think about chemo checkpoint. How do you think of which one to do first?
Well, the checkpoint data, again, has an OS benefit that's been reported recently. And so that always, as a clinician in solid tumor oncology, impresses me. And so I think I'd probably have to go with that tack in that kind of a case. For that reason.
I totally agree with you. I would also do the checkpoint just because I don't think the checkpoint inhibitors work very well in later line settings, as we've seen in breast cancer. And I want to make sure that they get that OS benefit with upfront utilization, whereas PARP has had benefit in the later line setting.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pegram and Dr. Tulaney. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. As a reminder, view the full program, Smarter, Stronger Together, Optimizing Personalized Triple-Negative Breast Cancer Care for Providers and Patients. On the Clinical Care Options website, please click on the link in the show notes. As always, thanks for listening.